Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's May 1st, 2014 7th Annual Conference, Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin chaired this 12-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 5, Dodd-Frank Developments, Documentation and Clearing. Michael Phillip and Thomas D'Ambrosio will discuss an overview of recent Dodd-Frank developments, including documentation and clearing. Now, on to the podcast.
Hello, everybody. We're here today to talk to you about the documentation and clearing issues that have arisen in the wake of Dodd-Frank and the rules and regulations that have been implemented since its passage in 2010. Briefly, I'm sure many of you are aware of everything that Dodd-Frank has done and will continue to do over the course of the next several years. But Dodd-Frank creates a regime in the United States which revamps the way OTC derivatives worked. And so what it requires is the reporting of swap transactions, the clearing of swap transactions. So swaps are no longer bilateral. They have to be cleared if the regulators say that the swaps are subject to mandatory clearing. The mandatory exchange trading of swaps that are required to be cleared. And with that, the registration of new entities called swap execution facilities. When these entities are registered, and many are already registered, at least provisionally so, they make a determination as to whether or not a mandatorily cleared trade is made available for trading, or MAT. And once the SEF has decided that a trade is made available for trading, then the transaction must be traded on the SEF. Dodd-Frank requires the registration of swap dealers and security-based swap dealers. We'll talk a little bit about that later, and major participants in the market. That is so the regulator will then know who's doing what and then can impose business conduct rules on the dealers, capital requirements upon the dealers, making sure that the dealers are properly engaged in reporting and record-keeping activity. And Dodd-Frank will also impose margin upon trades. In the past, parties could decide whether or not they wanted to post margin and ride on the credit of their counterparty or not. Now, that's not going to be the case in most situations. And finally, the Dodd-Frank creates position limits for derivative transactions. I say Dodd-Frank because really talking about the United States, but this is happening across the globe. It's similar regulation is being implemented in Europe through, briefly speak about that as well, and will also be implemented in other countries. The rest of the world is a little bit behind the implementation of these goals than the United States. Briefly on reporting, Dodd-Frank requires reporting. Reporting is in effect. Swap trades now must be reported. They are reported to something called an SDR, or swap data repository. And type of entity receives all information regarding the trade. The regime in the United States is that generally the dealer has the duty to report. So if you're a hedge fund, you don't need to worry about reporting in most cases. If your counterparty is a dealer, the dealer will be shouldering that reporting obligation. But the non-dealer does have a duty to provide certain information to the dealer. And these duties creep into the documentation through the various protocols. We'll discuss that as well. Reporting is also required under if an EU counterparty is involved. Reporting is a little bit different. And Mike, do you have a couple of things
sure.
to say about that?
The reporting mandate was a G20 undertaking. So all of the G20 countries agreed to institute reporting requirements, the purpose being to provide post-trade transparency and also so that presumably the regulators would have sufficient data to develop a comprehensive picture of the risk in the market. You would have hoped or expected or thought that maybe the global regulators would have adopted the same reporting regimes, but it isn't so. And because of that, and we'll illustrate that with the difference between the U.S. and the reporting regime, there's some question as to whether the way it's been implemented actually subverts those goals of transparency and information. So, for example, what must be reported? In the U.S., its derivatives, specifically swaps and options, have to be reported to a swap data repository. On the other hand, all derivatives have to be reported, which includes exchange-traded derivatives such as futures. So you have a very different scope in the U.S. in terms of what must be reported. Also, under physical commodity transactions do not get reported, but in the U.S., physical forwards could get reported if both parties are not commercial users of the commodity. Who must report? In the U.S., one party reports, one of the two counterparties reports, and as Tom explained, there's a hierarchy as to who would be the reporting party, usually the swap dealer or major swap participant if they are a party. In the EU, both sides must report, although one could delegate to the other. To who is the reporting made? In the US, it's to a swap data repository. In the EU, it's a trade repository. So if you look at, have each created data repositories, but they don't have just one entity. They have one in the US, one in Europe. And so it's not possible to satisfy your reporting requirements simply by reporting to a single repository. You've got to send one set of data to the US, one set of data to the EU, and the data is not the same. The data fields are different. The EU data fields are fewer but more ambiguous, leading to issues as to interpretation as to what has to be reported. The other difference is in terms of timing. In the US, data needs to be reported as soon as technologically practicable, and in the EU, it's T plus one. So what you've got is a non-harmonized reporting regime and a possibility that a particular party could have to report a transaction both in the EU and in the US, depending what it's trading and who it's trading it with, and be faced with reporting different data to different repositories and the regulators not knowing what to do with it.
That's right. And the negative effect on procedures and systems as well. It is still, I guess, a work in progress. And in some quarters, there's been promises of harmonization, but there's a lot that needs to be harmonized. Clearing. Clearing is currently in effect in the United States for certain interest rate and credit default index products. Clearing is not yet in effect in Europe, but that's going to happen this year. In the United States, more asset classes are expected to be covered in the clearing mandate. And just briefly, what happens there is the applicable regulator for swaps, the CFTC, for security-based swaps, the SEC, they will make a determination as to whether or not the actual type of swap or security-based swap should be subject to mandatory clearing. If they make that determination, then the trade can't go off unless it's cleared, unless an exemption applies. There really aren't a bunch of exemptions. The biggest one is the commercial end user exemption from the clearing requirement, but hedge funds can't take advantage of that. Just under clearing will become effective, it's expected this year, and it will apply to non-financial counterparties whose swap activity exceeds a certain threshold. So financial counterparties will be covered, but also non-financial counterparties whose use of derivatives exceed a certain threshold. If you don't exceed that threshold, then you would not be caught up in the clearing regime under. So again, this is another situation where there is not harmonization in what types of trades could be subject to clearing, because it would be more party-specific than in the United States. Obviously, because of the regulatory change, there is a great need to take the existing documentation and transactional structures that have been used in the past and make it work. It's not easy. And so the industry has come up with a variety of solutions to do this in a less expensive way than through bilateral amendments of every single trading relationship that's out there. And so ISDA is a big player in implementing these solutions. They're called protocols. It is likely that you've already adhered to two of them. The two big ones in the United States so far are the ISDA August 2012 Dodd-Frank Protocol and the March 2013 Dodd-Frank Protocol. Don't be fooled by their dates. Actual adherence came much later. Both of these protocols are designed to address most of the CFTC rules and regulations that apply to dealers and rules that require dealers to take certain actions with respect to their counterparties. The August protocol addressed external business conduct rules that were imposed upon the dealer. So the dealer had these burdens under these CFTC rules. It could satisfy the rules with certain representations. The protocol gives the dealer the necessary representations to take advantage of the safe harbor. It is important to know these protocols provide information to the dealer, but contain factual information and representations. And in our experience, what has happened is the dealer has approached parties, not necessarily with a lot of advance notice, and saying, look, we're not going to trade with you anymore unless you put these documents in place. And that's all well and good. And some were able to be on top of it and really analyze what's contained in the protocols, and others weren't. And for those that are in the latter category, the challenge is, of course, now you have a document, sizable document, with significant representations and significant obligations. And you need to make sure that the representations are correct, and you need to make sure that your procedures and your policies are in place to support the new obligations that you have as a result of adhering to the protocol. Just for example, and the March protocol contains a whole section devoted to portfolio reconciliation, and that is the process by which a dealer and its counterparty agree on what's out there, what trades are out there, what are the terms of the trades, etc. There are a variety of ways under the Dodd-Frank protocol to reconcile the portfolio, and depending upon the method that is selected, that creates burdens for the counterparty. So the dealers are all up on this because the dealers participate in the preparation of the protocol, but not necessarily the hedge funds that have signed these and have not had a chance to really delve down at them. So it's important to understand the representations. It's important to understand that you have to have processes in place to fulfill certain of the requirements. I mean, there's timing requirements on if the dealer should send you information about your portfolio, you'll need to review that within a certain period of time, object within a certain period of time. And if you blow those, there's a potential problem. In Europe, we have a similar endeavor on the part of ISDA to comply with applicable law. And the first one is the protocol. The protocol, what that does is through a series of representations, it gives the dealer an idea of whom it is dealing with. Therefore, the dealer will know if the trade will potentially be subject to clearing or what other obligations the dealer might have in connection with the trade. Similarly, it has a portfolio reconciliation requirement that's dealt with in another protocol that ISDA has developed. With respect to reporting of trades, the dealer has the responsibility in the United States, and both parties potentially have the responsibility in Europe to report these trades to some sort of repository. The problem with that is that oftentimes the documentation that's currently in effect has confidentiality provisions. So one of the concerns that parties have in reporting is, oh, gee, okay, well, the rule requires me to report, but I could be breaching a whole bunch of agreements that I have, or perhaps even rules and regulations. And so there are the reporting protocols that deal with the ability to provide information to the repository without any sort of adverse consequence on the reporting party. Now that trades have to be cleared, or at least some trades have to be cleared, there are new players that are in the market. And clearing will require a new party, usually a dealer or a dealer affiliate, but it's called a futures commission merchant. And for those parties that have not dealt in the futures market and really only dealt with OTC derivatives, this is a new player. It's a new structure that needs to be contemplated. So when you have futures commission merchant, you need a futures account agreement. You need various addendum to that agreement to contemplate how clear derivative trades will be implemented and what happens should they be canceled or if they fail to clear. Just a couple of these things. There's one that's specifically produced by ISDA, and that's called the addendum for clear derivative transactions. There is some negotiation on that, not a lot, but you should be aware that these documents will normally be presented to you on a kind of just sign it as is basis. Both the futures account agreement and the clear derivatives addendum do get modified slightly. Actually, the futures agreement can get modified in some significant manner in some significant instances, doesn't look very significant, but they are very significant. There's also something called the clear derivatives execution agreement. You might see that falling out of favor because you're not allowed to have breakage agreements when you trade on a CEF. But that still might be a document that is asked for by the dealer to contemplate trades that are not traded on a CEF. Clearing will have new margin requirements. So you can't negotiate your margin anymore. Your margin requirement is what the clearinghouse says it is, plus whatever the FCM asks for in addition. So that's a very important distinction between the cleared market and the non-cleared market. And Mike had some very interesting observations about portfolio margining.
Yeah, speaking of margin, I mean, typically in the U.S., margin's been handled by the type, what you're trading, that will determine what sort of account it's in. So if you're trading securities or equity options, it's got to be in a securities account. If you're trading futures, it has to be in a futures account. Foreign futures account. Swaps, a cleared swaps account. And each of those accounts have to be margined separately. So what happens if you're trading credit default swap indices, which are swaps, and have to be carried and margined in a cleared swaps customer account, and you're trading those opposite or against single name CDS, which are security-based swaps, which have to be housed and margined in a securities account. And the regulators would require full margin for both sets of positions, even though they may be risk offsetting. So that's a very uneconomic result. To solve that, other clearinghouses have applied for portfolio margining relief from the CFTC and the SEC to rationalize the margin process so that you could look at the portfolio of related instruments, even though they're in separate accounts, as one pot and just margin them as a whole. But to do that, at least in the credit default swap context, what happens is that the single name, those positions and the margin affiliated with that would be held in the CFTC's cleared swap account. And the SEC finally approved that, but said, if you're going to do that, you, the customer, have to sign a subordination agreement with your broker-dealer FCM whereby you agree and acknowledge that if the BDFCM becomes insolvent, you will not have a claim as you normally would to insurance. You would not be able to make a claim under the securities bankruptcy, but rather your claims would be under the commodity customer bankruptcy. And so any of your securities claims would be subordinated to the other security customers of the insolvent BDFCM. And it's just an additional piece of documentation that you would need to sign if you're going to avail yourself of portfolio margin. The trade-off for more efficient margin may mean different treatment under the bankruptcy code.
Yeah, absolutely. So the name of the game is more documentation because it's going to be the only way to accommodate the changes that occur. And along those lines, to utilize the services of a CEF, you'll need additional documentation. Want to speak about that?
Sure. Before jumping into the CEF documentation, I want to talk about one of the perhaps unappreciated or unintended consequences of becoming a member of a swap execution facility. As Tom alluded to before, certain swaps, interest rate swaps and CDS, are now subject to the made available to trade, which means they must be traded on a swap execution facility. So you have to decide, are you going to become a member or are you going to seek intermediated access? What people don't always appreciate is that simply by obtaining direct electronic access to the CEF, if that's offered to you, if that's granted to you by the CEF, you're now a member. And as a member, you're subject to a number of requirements, including record-keeping requirements. Now, everyone who's a member of a futures exchange or a CEF, regardless if they're registered with the CFTC or not, if you're a member, you're subject to the written record-keeping requirements. Everyone's understood that. That includes written records, including IMs, chat, emails, written documents relating to orders and transactions leading to a swap or a futures contract. But what people didn't fully appreciate is that the CFTC also said that if you are certain categories of members of CEFs, particularly CTAs, not CPOs, but registered CTAs, have to also keep oral records, meaning tape recordings of all conversations leading to the execution of a swap or a futures contract. And people didn't completely appreciate the burden of that. The CIFMA has obtained a no action letter from the CFTC recently in April, got it extended till the end of this year, which is a relief from the oral record keeping requirements, but only with respect to swaps and not with respect to other futures contracts on a DCM with respect to CTAs. So that's one of perhaps the unintended consequences that could happen to you if you become a member of a CEF. In terms of CEF documentation, I think it's really important to understand that right now there are 24 temporarily registered CEFs. The most important document is the rule book, because that's really your contract governing, and all the rule books are different. There's no uniform CEF rule book. You need to read them very carefully. The participation agreements and the user agreements for electronic access that each of the CEFs have are different, and there's some real significant consequences. In part, there are really four types of CEFs in terms of where they came from. You had CEFs that were sponsored by traditional exchanges, so their rules are much more like the futures exchange rules. You have CEFs that were formed by the interdealer brokers, Tradition, GFI, ICAP. You had CEFs that are dealer-sponsored, and some are just, you know, more technology company-oriented. And so what you'll find is very significant differences in the limitation of liability provisions, indemnification provisions, IP provisions. Who has to become the member? Is it the fund? Is it the fund manager, the investment manager? Enablement provisions, bunched order provisions, they all vary and will all be very important. And so you have to really focus on the differences between the CEF rules in that regard. So let's say you decide, you know what, I don't want the hassle of becoming a member of a CEF. I'll be happy just to get intermediated access through a broker. Have I solved all my problems? Not completely, because the CFTC required that every CEF implement rules that bind all market participants, not members, to the rules of the CEF. So even if you decide not to become a member of the CEF, you need to be cognizant of the rules, because you will be bound to the limitations of liabilities, indemnifications, trade practices, position limits, and the disciplinary procedures. And in that area, it's interesting to note that the sanctions authorities that the CEFs have set out in the rules vary very widely. Some who will only impose very low fines, some who reserve the right to impose very high fines. So it's important to do due diligence on the rules of whatever CEF you're going to trade on, even if you're not a member. You'll see void ab initios up there, and you know, as a lawyer, I can't resist throwing out a Latin term, but this is thanks to the CFTC. The expectation for CEF trades that are cleared that the CFTC had is that it'll be basically straight through processing. There needs to be a pre-trade credit check by the, and then only if the customer's order passes that does it get sent to the CEF and matched. And then the expectation is that that gets passed through to the clearinghouse and accepted within 10 seconds. So very quick, seamless approach is the idea, and that's to promote the clearing of swaps. Well, many dealers and others were quite concerned originally about, well, what happens if for some reason the clearinghouse does not accept the trade, it's rejected, what happens? And ISDA, FIA had drafted breakage agreements which would specify what would happen to the non-accepted trade. The CFTC came out at the end of last year and said, no, breakage agreements will not be permitted for CEFs. Bottom line is, if the clearinghouse rejects the trade is just void ab initio, null and void. You cannot impose breakage agreements on it. They then said that if both parties agree, the trade could be resubmitted on the same economic terms and cleared, but it would require the agreement of both parties. But the bottom line is no breakage agreements in the context of CEF trades that are intended to be cleared. I want to touch on one other issue, which is not really a documentation issue, but it's kind of an operational issue, which is package transactions. It's quite common for people not just to trade outright swaps, but to trade one swap contract as a spread against another swap, or a swap versus a non-swap like a security. The position of the CFTC is that if in these package transactions, which they're executed at a single price, in other words, as a package, and you only do one component if all components are done, that if one component is a made available to trade swap, then the whole package has to be traded on a CEF. The industry pointed out many issues with that, and the CFTC has granted no action relief, which is going to run out on May 15th. So right now, package transactions don't have to be traded on a CEF, even if one or more elements are made available to trade. But that relief is going to end on May 15th. No one really knows how that's going to come out. There have been proposals that package transactions be traded as block trades. There have been proposals that the relevant made available to trade determination shouldn't be on the component, but rather on the whole package. And so if a CEF hasn't made a package made available to trade, then it shouldn't be required to all be traded on a CEF. We'll see how that plays out.
Little item about the security-based swaps. Security-based swaps are regulated by the SEC, which is far, far behind the CFTC vis-a-vis its rulemaking. So in the future, we need to expect additional protocols that will deal with security-based swaps and additional voluminous rulemaking by the SEC, but we don't really know what the timing on that would be. They just recently came out with some rules regarding record-keeping and reporting requirements for dealers on April 17th, but that's their first step in a long time addressing rules that they need to adopt under Dodd-Frank. Well, thank you very much.
To listen to other panels from the 2014 7th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit PodcastCentral at morganlewis.com. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefundsresources.